Good morning, brothers, sisters, and honored guests. It is good to see you all here at High. I would even say it is great, since it is the beginning of a spiritual retreat, which should leave us all very refreshed at the end. You have just been read Deuteronomy chapter 2, and I have been asked to serve the Ecclesia in opening comments, a task in which I am both honored and pleased to take. We'll begin in verses 1 through 3. We see that Israel, after their defeat at Kadesh, is refused a shortcut through the land of Edom. And then they begin their travels by way of the Red Sea, compassing Seir many days. After which the Lord finally commands them to begin their northward journey. And concerning these events, looking for more detailed explanations of the exact locations in which they go, you can reference Numbers chapter 20, verses 21 and 22. And going back to Deuteronomy, I would also like to add that verse 3 says, "Ye have compassed this mountain long enough," which was also much like what you see in chapter 1 while the Israelites were in Horeb. Mention of their detailed travels, again, can be found in another place in Numbers in chapter 33, verses 35 through 37, which speak of this period between crossing the Ezion Geber, camping at Kadesh, and the beginning of the wandering time period following and then concluding, or at least partially, at Mount Hor, where Aaron died. Going through verses 4 through 8, you begin seeing their travels to end their period of their time in the wilderness. God specifically tells them not to meddle with Edom. In this instruction, he tells them to pay for any food that they buy and for any water that they drink. In verse 7, you see Moses saying, "God hath blessed thee in all the works of thy hand. These 40 years thou hast lacked for nothing," like Brother Burl said earlier. Not only have they been provided for completely, but they have been abundantly and excessively blessed if they can afford to buy meat and water on their journey for an entire nomadic nation of people. You're talking about a land which Brother Jim mentioned earlier was nothing but rocks and sand for a lot of their journey. If you can be blessed enough to be financially able to buy meat and water for a nation, that's pretty amazing. God still has not left his people. He may be angry, but he has not left them. Going forward to Psalms chapter 136, verse 16, you see thanks for this. "To him which led his people through the wilderness, may his mercy endureth forever." The Lord also says here that he will not give Edomite land into Israel's possession. To wonder why he says this, you should remember the blood ties that are present between the Israelites and the Edomites. The people following Moses were descendant of Jacob, and the people in Edom were descendant of Esau, as Genesis chapter 36, verses 1 and 8 can both be said. Esau is Edom. That is his nation. And they were all descendant of Abraham. In Amos chapter 1, and also in Obadiah chapter 12, you have mention of the brotherly covenant, which should not be broken. Specific mentions of not giving land for possession also makes me think of the book of Daniel, chapter 4, where you can find in verse 17, it says, "The living may know that the Most High ruleth in the kingdoms of men and giveth it to whomever he will." In essence, God determines military prowess of the Napoleons and the Hitlers of our ages. He determines the borders in which Russia, China, anybody else of any era will expand to. And all of that, we must remember, he does to continue to prove his majesty and his power. He uses it for his purpose, as I will mention further along in my comments. Moving forward to verses 9 through 12, God instructs the Israelites to not disturb or battle with the Moabites, who were also descendants of Lot, brother to Abraham. Yet again, blood ties and the brotherly covenant come into play. Following that, you can see an accounting of some history regarding the overthrow of the Ammonites, which were likened to the Anakims by the Moabites. Some of you may recall from this morning in chapter 1, verse 28, that the Anakims were part of two significant events. They were part of what made the Israelites mumble. They were part of what made them afraid. And then they were also there when Israel attacked and helped drive them out and chase them as bees. Verses 13 through 15 deal with the death of the old generation, the men of war, and the crossing of Zered. The new generation was finally able to cease their wandering entirely and begin earnestly moving towards the land of promise. Now, while they were at the Brook of Zered, there must have been some sort of distinct or lengthy pause, evidenced probably by the phrase, "Now rise up," found in verse 13. This pause was likely to let the rest of the men of war be consumed, as the Lord swore, and can also be seen in Psalms chapter 95. And you also must remember, when they were crossing the Brook of Zered, the land must have started to significantly look better than anything that they had seen during the time in their wilderness. Maybe it wasn't in a plush, fertile grasslands or verdant forests, but it must have been something better than nothing but rocks and sand. So that started to give the new generation hope as they continued their travels through Moabite lands. Verses 16 through 23 can be grouped together because they discuss what the Lord tells his people not to distress the children of Ammon, along with more history detailing the history of conquest between the people who had been there before. And not distressing the Ammonites, part of it can be attributed to the blood ties also leading back to Lot. Note here that the Lord tells them not to have anything to do with the Ammonites. So instead of just saying, do not disturb them, or do not meddle with them, he says both. And to remember, if you look at the Hebrew here, to disturb means to attack, and to meddle means to have anything to do with at all. Do not integrate yourselves with them. This could be seen as very good advice, since to steadfastly follow the law, Israel should have no dealings with people who have no mind for Yahweh. This could be very, very similar to today in the world we live in now, in which we face spiritual assaults from every side and from every way imaginable. And we must keep ourselves separate from the world, though we must reside in it, to reduce the amount of risk to our spiritual well-being. Now, the Ammonites, between the two tribes descending from Lot, can be seen, or seemingly so, to be more fleshly-centered and fierce. If you look in 1 Samuel chapter 11, he says that I may thrust out all your right eyes and lay it for a reproach upon all of Israel. That's an Ammonite speaking. And also, in Amos chapter 1, that the Ammonites have ripped up the women with children of women with children in Gilead to enlarge their border. We have an example of simple hatred and brutality. I want to take out your eyes as a reproach for all of Israel. And from the second, we have brutality, covetousness, and murder. just because they simply wanted to expand their borders. How wise must it have been for the Lord to instruct Israel to have nothing to do with Ammon at all? The final section contains the remaining verses 24 through 37. These verses detail the beginning of the conquest of the kingdoms of Sihon and Og. But before I continue, I would like to remind you of some words that you can find in a much earlier book of the Bible, Genesis chapter 15. While Abraham was in a deep sleep, the Lord came to him and told him all of the things that would be happening to his people. He tells him about the coming captivity in Egypt, how it will take 400 years. He tells him about the Exodus, how he will set his people free, and when they leave Egypt, they will leave so abundantly blessed. He also tells them something that you can really link to what is about to happen in the next verses. In verse 16, he tells Abraham that in the fourth generation, the Israelites will come to the promised land again. For the Lord said, the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet full. Now remember, the Amorites are the people of Sihon, the first people to be utterly destroyed. Moses, going back to Deuteronomy, sends out communication to Sihon, a treaty to allow Israel to pass through his lands via the highway, not stopping until they are on the western banks of the Jordan, at the original promised land. Reference to this law of battles can be found in Deuteronomy chapter 20. Sihon refuses, and they battle at the banks of the Arnon River. This is the very first victory that the new generation of Israel has, and it's very decisive for two reasons. It had profound effects on Israel's enemies, and it gives the new generation assurance that the Lord will take them to the promised land. For the profound effects on the enemies, you can flip to Joshua chapter 9, where Rahab voices fear of the Israelites because of their conquests in Sihon and Og, which were very prominent military powers in that time. Again, referencing back to the Lord will build up military power and simply let it be overthrown to show his power and glory. The same could be said of the Egyptians. He continued to harden Pharaoh's heart to be able to do the plagues, to show his power and glory, to give his people hope. The second message, like I said, is one to the Israelites, is that with the Lord, they are assured and they are capable of doing anything. In Romans, Paul says much of the same about overcoming our greatest adversaries, in particular, the flesh. In chapter 8, verse 31, if God be for us, who can be against us? Who can we not defeat with the Lord on our side? If he is enough to contend with our greatest enemy, ourselves, what can he not help us accomplish? The next prominent military victory for Israel came at Jahaz, where Sihon had amassed an army, which was in turn completely decimated and trodden underfoot. The meaning of Jahaz is very significant here, because it also means to literally be trodden under your feet, as Sihon's army was. This defeat opened the floodgates, essentially. Israel stormed across the land, conquering Amorite territory, city after city. It says, they took all of his cities at that time and utterly destroyed all of his people. Now you must ask yourself, why would you do that? Parents, family members. I know how I would feel if somebody asked me to kill children. I don't know if I'd be able to do it. I don't know if I'd be able to kill at all. But if you look at Numbers chapter 33, verse 55, it speaks of having to destroy the inhabitants, or they'll grow up to be a pain in your heel. They'll always resent you. They'll always hate you for taking over their territory, killing their family members, killing their friends. And they will undermine every effort you have. Think of it like an ant colony. If you don't kill it entirely, it's going to come back. It's still going to be there and it's still going to give you problems. In closing, I can say that the Israelites, following this, yet again in Psalms, offer praise for this in verses chapter 136, verses 19 through 22. Because they say, praise Yahweh for delivering us, Sihon and Og, and giving us their land to possess. His mercy endures forever.
I'd like to thank our brother Daniel. This chapter is now open for comments.
I really just have a question for anyone to perhaps answer. Brother Daniel brought out the battle between Sihon and the children of Israel, and they came to fight at Jahaz. He mentioned that it meant to trot upon. I believe that's the same word as threshing, and I'm wondering if there's some relation to that, to the battle of the future of Armageddon, and thus the entire wiping out of everything except for the cattle. I'm just wondering if somebody could comment on that.
Brother?
Yeah. Brother Chairman, brother and sisters, Brother Daniel talked about this chapter, and we see the first chapter, Moses dealt with their 40 years wandering. This chapter, we now are in the 40th year. It's the last year, and they're about to go into the land, and there's encouragement for this generation. But, there's always that but, we read virtually nothing of their 38 years of wandering, but we read a fair amount of this 40th year, this last year. And it's interesting, Esau, or Edom, the brother of Jacob or Israel, they're on their 39th year, they're in their 40th year. They come right up to the border of the land. Miriam dies that year, and they come to Edom, and there's a highway that they could pass through right on up into the land. And they send an ambassage to Esau, their brother, someone that they should expect a favor of, someone that they should be able to cooperate with. Let us pass, I pray thee, through thy country. We will not pass through the fields nor through the vineyards, neither will we drink of the water of thy wells. We will go by the king's highway. We will not turn to the right hand nor to the left until we have passed thy borders. And Edom said unto him, thou shalt not pass by me, lest I come out against thee with the sword. And the children of Israel said unto him, we will go by the king's highway, and if I and my cattle drink of thy water, then I will pay for it. I will only, without doing anything else, go through on my feet. And he said, thou shalt not go through. And Edom came out against him with much people and with a strong hand. Thus Edom refused to give Israel passage through his border. Wherefore Israel turned away from him. And the children of Israel and the whole congregation journeyed from Kadesh and came to Mount Hor. Now we know Mount Hor is where Aaron died. So we have the death of Miriam just a few verses before this incident, and the death of Aaron. and they were, instead of being allowed to go by the King's Highway and go up to the land of Israel, they're driven back. So this 40th year was no picnic to them. As a matter of fact, it was one of the worst years they've experienced. Like you say, you're psyched up, you're at the last year, you're going to go in, and yet now, instead of being allowed to go in, they're turned back southeast, back into one of the worst areas of that whole entire region. It's a terrible area there south of Edom. It says, and they journeyed from Mount Hor by the way of the Red Sea to compass the land of Edom. They had to go around Edom. And the soul of the people was much discouraged because of the way. And the people spake against God and against Moses. Wherefore have ye brought us up out of Egypt to die in the wilderness? For there is no bread. No bread. They had manna. They had bread from heaven. Men did eat angels' food, we're told. As far as they're concerned, he says, for there is no bread, neither is there any water, and our souls loathe this light bread. They were sick and tired of the manna. They had eaten it for the last 38 years, and they were expecting to go into the land. And now they're driven back into the wilderness, and they weren't happy. And yet this brought one of the swiftest punishments onto them. And yet with that swift punishment comes a type that Christ used. It says, and the Lord sent fiery serpents among the people, and they bit the people, and much of the people died. That generation had to be finished off. And it was in this way with the serpents, in the last year before they entered the land. And so this last incident finishes it up. And Christ uses that as an example of himself. He says, even as Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, so shall the Son of Man be lifted up. That brass serpent hanging there on the pole. Christ said, you know that serpent? That's me. That's the symbol of sin. That was what was destroying the people. How in any way can Christ say, that's me? But when we understand what he was talking about, we see a beautiful picture. That's sin's flesh. That's what we're dealing with here. That's what Christ was dealing with. And that's what was destroyed and hung up on the pole for all Israel to look to. And that's why we partake of the bread and the wine on Sunday morning. We see that body of sin, broken, destroyed, the serpent hanging on the pole, defeating this which we're reading of, defeating the murmuring, the emotions of the flesh. And right there in Israel's worst moment, because their brother refused to cooperate with them, we see the type of Christ and the eventual salvation of Israel. Those that looked to the serpent were not killed and went up within a few months up into the land.
Start with Brother Matthew.
First of all, thanks, Brother Daniel, for those introductory thoughts and very fitting conclusion and reference, I thought, to Psalm 137. And following on from our thoughts earlier about the murmuring of the people of Israel, whether in or out of their tents, as we discussed, which eroded their faith and rendered them a people void of that attribute which is pleasing to God and would have prepared them for the coming entry into the land of Israel. By contrast, in Psalm 137, we have what I believe is the counterbalance to that natural condition of the flesh, and that is praise. The murmuring and the displeasure is often a natural attribute of the flesh, but to resist that, I think we need to have our minds filled with the things of the Spirit. Brother Jim brought out earlier that it's a prohibition on us to murmur and to be disputing. It's also a command for us to rejoice. Paul says unto us, rejoice, and I say unto you again, rejoice. Brother Grocott describes unhappiness as vision failure. I know there is such a thing as medical depression, and I'm not wishing to attack that condition, but generally speaking, if we find ourselves in an unhappy frame of mind, we are failing to see beyond Kadesh Barnea. If we look in Psalm 137, we read that constant refrain which Brother Daniel finished up, "For his mercy endureth forever." He made Israel to pass through the wilderness, "For his mercy endureth forever." Led his people through the Red Sea, "For his mercy endureth forever." To him which smote great kings, "For his mercy endureth forever." And it goes on with that continual echoing refrain, "For his mercy endureth forever." Brother Grocott says, if we've been offered immortality, deathlessness, we've been offered everything, we've been given the world is yours. If we can't be happy with that, I believe we can't be happy with anything. So I think it's incumbent upon us to remember our blessings, to be conscious of all we've been given, and to allow that state of thankfulness and praise and joyfulness in the things of the truth to fill our hearts and our lives.
Brother Jim, be next. Jim Phillips.
To address the question that Brother Dan asked as to whether the things we're witnessing here are a type of Armageddon, I think as we think about the way the plan of the March of the Rainbowed Angel moves, this is prior to moving down into Jerusalem. This is probably the last battle that the saints do before they enter into the Holy Land to go down to Jerusalem. So this isn't a clash of the great nation, the King of the North that the saints are coming upon. But this is just shows that the saints will fight their way up to Jerusalem and into the land, and then of course have their great victories at Jerusalem and the Armageddon, the Valley of Threshing, or in the hills of Megiddo, probably the final battle, but in that region. So this is still preparatory to the Battle of Armageddon as we consider the type of Moses' journeys.
Brother Glendon is next.
Thank you, Brother Jim, for answering that question. I was quite interested in that as well. My comment had to do with verse 11 and verse 20. Detailed out for us here quite clearly. He says, "Distrust not the Moabites, for I will not give you of your land, because I have given Ar unto the children of Lot for a possession." So he says specifically, "I gave Ar to the children of Lot for a possession." They weren't the people that I called out to be my special nation, but I still gave them a land. And then he says, "The Emims dwelt there in time past, a people great and many and tall as the Anakims, which also were accounted giants as the Anakims, but the Moabites called them Emims." And then he goes on talking about the children of Lot there in verse 19 and 20. "Meddle not with them, because I have given it unto the children of Lot for a possession. That also was accounted a land of giants. Giants dwelt there in old times, and the Ammonites call them Zamzumin, a people great and many and tall as the Anakims, but the Lord destroyed them before them, and they succeeded them and dwelt in their stead." Now to a considerate mind in the children of Israel, that should have immediately drawn them back to, why didn't we go up into our land that God had said He would give us? We were afraid of the giants. The children of Anak were there. They were tall. We were as grasshoppers in their sight, is what the spies said when they came back. But to a considerate mind, they should have said, God has given us special promises and given us a huge deliverance from Egypt. He's already performed miracles for us. Why would He have brought in the children of Lot and the children of Edom into their inheritance full of giants and then not bring us in? How would that happen? How would He bring in these other people and dispossess giants and not do it for us? Of course He would do it for us, but it would take a considerate mind to make that connection. What are the history of these other people in the land? Did they have something similar happen? And then increase their faith. And I guess the lesson for us then is to be considerate Of course, it's supposed to be considerate of others, but I mean, be considerate in the sense of think about things enough to take the lessons from them. You know, think about the things that we're exposed to, the situations that we read about history, and find the lesson for us in that, so that when we do meet our giants, we say, yeah, this has already happened. Matter of fact, it happened with someone that had less of a relationship with God than we do. So why would our faith waver now?
Brother Burrell will be next, and we're starting to get towards the end of class, so if anybody else has a comment, go on and raise your hand, and I'll write you down.
In regards to what was said about the future applications, I agree wholeheartedly with what Brother Jim Phillips has said, but I do feel that there is a lesson or a type or an example, however you want to put it, in this. If we look at the 25th verse, he says that this day I will begin to put the dread of thee and the fear of thee upon the nations that are under the whole heaven, and who shall hear the report of thee, and shall tremble and be in anguish because of thee. We know that the Queen of Sheba heard a report and came to put Solomon to hard questions and found that it was a true report. Babylon heard the report of the Medo-Persians and trembled. God takes notice of the reports of the nations around. And when we think about the what happened with Israel here, there were nations that they came in and they passed through the land and didn't touch them. They bought food with and water with gold from they brought from Egypt. Those nations who helped Israel were rewarded. But then we come to the next nation, Sihon, and that nation was not rewarded, or it was given a totally different reward, however you want to look at it. They were brought low and taken out of the way. They didn't want to help Israel. They wanted to fight against Israel. And this shows, again, in the future time, in the future state, when Christ returns, there will be nations who will be rewarded or treated kindly by Israel or by God for helping Israel. And there'll be nations that, as we well know, that will be utterly destroyed for coming against Israel. And we can see that clearly as happening when Israel begins to come into the land now.
Are there any more comments?
I'd like to add my thanks to Brother Daniel. I thought he did a great summary on that chapter, and I particularly thought that he was pretty good in pointing out to us the blessings which the children of Israel received throughout their wanderings. And I think that's important as an exhortation for us, because sometimes we're ignorant of our blessings, or we choose not to recognize them, and we can be very forgetful of them. And I was also thinking, when we were considering this chapter, Brother Daniel, in the course of his exhortation, and a number of the brethren have remarked upon the same points, he referred more than once to this new generation, this new generation. Now, of course, we're all, a lot of us anyway, are parents, and we tend to naturally, and it's a good thing, we tend to naturally be concerned about our children, and we worry about our children, and I think that's right. Well, it's very wise of us to do those things. We should take care concerning our children. We recognize, as it says in Ezekiel, that they're Yahweh's children. So we do naturally want to do the best for our children. But a number of the comments, and Brother Jim Somerville sort of like summarized the difficulties of the way in a really great way. I mean, as one brother said, Yahweh did give them every opportunity to complain. It was a waste, howling wilderness. It wasn't easy. But whoever said it was going to be easy to get to the kingdom? Whoever said it was going to be easy to go to the promised land? But of course, the children of Israel lacked faith, made it more difficult for themselves. But on this aspect of children, you know, these were the little boys and girls that we're reading about now, that 38 years earlier were little boys and girls, but these are now little boys and girls grown up. I'm thinking back to the time when they were at Kadesh Barnea. And Brother Glendon made reference to the fact of this aspect of seeing the problems. We saw the sons of Anak there. We saw the cities great and walled up to heaven. We saw the giants. It was all with the eye of the flesh. They didn't see with the eye of faith. And their great concern and their great excuse was the concern of their children. Because we read in Numbers 14, it said, verse 3, "Wherefore hath Yahweh brought us unto this land to fall by the sword, that our wives and our children should be a prey? Would it not be better for us to return into Egypt?" It is a natural concern about our children. And the previous generation were really concerned about their children. And I know sometimes we're a very small group, very small fellowship. I know we've had talks within our own ecclesia at Hengoid. Well, we're only small. What's going to happen to our children? They're only little. What's going to happen when they grow up? This generation we're talking about now were those little boys and girls that their parents were so worried about. Their parents were dead. As Paul said in Corinthians, their carcasses littered the wilderness. Their carcasses littered the wilderness. On average, 600 people a day were dying. And they were being buried. They were littered in the wilderness. 600 people a day on average to get rid of 2 million faithless children of Israel. And here we have the new generation. Their parents worried about them. But Yahweh looked after them. If they had only exercised the same amount of faith as this new generation did, they too would have been going into the promised land. And it was all epitomized by the fact that there were no really old people in this last 2 months. We're just in chapter 1 of Deuteronomy. We read it was in the 11th year of the 40th year, in the first day of the month. So this was the last 2 months of their wanderings that Deuteronomy was written. And actually probably the last month, because we know that when Moses died in the last chapter, they mourned for him 30 days. So really this was like a month of exhortation. And this was the new generation. And so we're coupled with warning and exhortation. We've got this new generation now who did experience problems in the wilderness. As Brother Jim said, whoever said it's going to be easy? But this was the generation. And it's an encouragement to us. This was the generation that was going to go forth and rout the people of the land and establish God's kingdom in the land of Palestine.